In his talk tonight, Professor Dorling will discuss the central importance of geography in Brexit, and will argue that the source of British woes may be, at least in part, an outcome of having so recently been at the heart of the largest empire the world has ever known. Please can you welcome Professor Danny Dorling.
Thank you ever so much for the invite. It's great to be here. I must start off by saying this, of course, is an incredibly serious subject. Possibly the most serious thing that has happened to this country, at least more serious than Suez, certainly since the Second World War. And I know there'll be a wide variety of views in the room, and I'm not intending to annoy anybody. But as you said, I did begin life as a play worker, and sometimes if you don't laugh at this, it does get all a bit too depressing. The British Empire. Why on earth have I stuck the British Empire in the title? It's because Sally Tomlinson and I, who began writing a book on this shortly after the referendum, trying to work out the reasons behind the reasons behind the reasons of why out of 28 countries should it be us, kept on coming back to the empire as the thing that was different about us. Sally's expertise is looking at special education, but also at old textbooks. What were we taught at school in the 1930s, 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s? She's read Boris Johnson's textbooks from his prep school, which included the phrase pickaninnies and watermelon smiles. So when you're worrying about the choices of words that Boris might use, you really ought to go back and think where they come from. And of course, when you look at how we voted differently by age, and we were educated differently, largely by age, but then divided. I'm going to zoom through. I've got far too many slides. I'm going to show you a whole series of images. Please think of questions for me. Absolutely remarkable times. In a matter of weeks, we've gone up to a new political party polling this weekend, at least. I haven't checked the news today. Things happen fast. Polling at the front of the opinion polls. This kind of thing doesn't even happen in France. You know, this it doesn't happen elsewhere. This is a graphic, that one was from The Guardian, this is a graphic I made myself in the style of really patronising BBC graphics, when the BBC just have three numbers, or even just two, and rather tell you the two numbers, they create these kind of cylinders and so on. This is a graphic the BBC never produced, but it was the results of local elections in terms of seats. When the Conservatives lost 1,330, UKIP lost 145, and Labour lost 84. And the comment on the BBC was that voters had delivered a stinging rebuke to the two main parties, because 84 and 1,330 are very similar numbers. I'm going to talk to you later about numeracy and Britain and Empire. And this is the book. Being advertised. So behind this flippant tree, there are 300 pages and 2 years of work to get to this. The book, incidentally, was published on the day of the first meaningful vote, 15th of January 2019. I think we've been told today or yesterday that we're going to be getting a not very meaningful vote coming up. And it contains lots of pictures, so I'll just show you some of them. This picture shows the wide diversity of political parties to which the richest people in Britain donate. And it's from the Rich List a couple of years ago. But one of the fascinating things about Brexit is that, well, these people, and especially the City of London, thought it had bought a political party, and have discovered to their complete shock that they haven't, and that the members of that party, 80,000, maybe 70, maybe 50,000 in reality, actually own it. Things you'd never have known. We have pictures of our border force. This is a British ship docked at Lesvos, 3 miles away from the Turkish border, to stop children and families crossing in dinghies, this kind of thing. It's how did it get to this question? We have cartoons. This one is from 1901 in the Daily Express, where the caption reads, "The pauper foreigner, how the government have been frustrated in their efforts to check alien immigration." The aliens, of course, in 1901 were coming from Eastern Europe mainly, and Russia, and they were Jewish. And we passed an Aliens Act, and we had a British Union of Fascists, which for a time rose in popularity. Another image from a newspaper. The subtitle of this reads, "Britannia, I can no longer offer shelter to fugitives. England is not a free country." And again, the fear of people coming. People seen painted as strange and different. But at this point, just after the height of empire, but even then, even back then, we could suddenly get very, very worried. We were carving up the world. We were top dog. You can take all the other empires of Europe and put them together, and they're not a match even combined to ours. Admittedly, we did take Germany's little empire off them at the end of the First World War. You can ask yourself whether in the long term it is actually beneficial to have had an empire or not, if you compare us to Germany, let alone, and much more importantly, for the people who we ruled over. We told ourselves a particular story about the empire. It's in our textbooks. It's a story about civilizing the world, about bringing trains, about bringing order, about bringing justice, about having the white man's burden, about how we gained nothing out of this. In fact, it was a terrible burden for us to do. That's what we told ourselves. It's what we still tell ourselves. The Geography A-level curriculum was altered by Michael Gove so that if you study somewhere abroad, it is South America. Because that's one of the few, in fact the only, part of the world where we didn't have many colonial possessions. So we still don't teach our children about what the empire actually was. Enoch Powell, a kind of force from the past, a man who was Secretary of State for Health, went out to the Caribbean and to India begging people to come over and be nurses. And bus drivers. And then within a few years of going out and asking, said how terrible it was that they were coming. Joseph P. Kelly very kindly let us use that image he's drawn, which is kind of an image about where we are now. And this lot, we do say a lot about politicians. This is Steve Bell's cartoon of the Bullingdon Club. You can no longer show the original picture, although I have it if anybody would like to see it. But the cartoon is kind of nicer. This is from, again, the weekend's papers. The Brexit Party clown. It is really interesting times. Not necessarily terrible times. I'll give you some optimism just early on. The nearest equivalent we have to this is Suez. Suez was a national humiliation. The Americans told us and the French that we couldn't do this. We had to crawl back. The canal became Egyptian. We were no longer a world power. We were humiliated. And within just a few years, we got the 1960s. And we got the young not having respect for the old, voting in a different way, getting a different government, getting changes in legislation so for the first time, if Kathy needed to come home and she was pushing her two kids around in a pram, she might actually get somewhere to sleep. Getting a change in education so that for the first time in British history, children in the majority of counties could go to school with the other children in their counties. Now, it didn't all come about because of Suez. But there are times in British histories when you get an acceleration of social progress, and it is often associated with blunders of the elite. In other countries, this is very, very typical. The fastest way to social progress is to lose a war. If you lose a war, you kick out the old families who are in charge, or they're kicked out by the invading forces. And whoever comes in, you can challenge me on this, but I can't find an example. Whoever comes in always appears to do a better job than those who were in before. We did this in our own small way. My grandfather was born during the First World War. The First World War was possibly excusable. Supposed to last a few weeks. It was a bit of a cock-up. Many people died. They came back. What wasn't excusable was allowing things to develop such that there had to be a Second World War. And so when my granddad came back from Berlin, he and his friends were absolutely determined that they were not going to take any advice from those who were older than them anymore, who'd made them go out to fight. And they voted in a completely and utterly new government and regime, much to the surprise of the existing government. When the elite get things wrong, the young get agitated and can act. So much has changed. This isn't very long ago. Opening a church fete in Maidenhead in her constituency, happy, smiling, relaxed, still the Home Secretary, I think, at this point. So much has changed so quickly, I think. I don't think it's just me. And we did things recently which are intimately connected with empire. After the war, people became British citizens all around the world. And then we decided to take away that, because just like the Jews from Eastern Europe, we became scared of people again. Operation Vaken, the word Vaken was used in Breivik's manuscript, his thesis. Breivik being the man who slaughtered all those children on the island. It may be a complete coincidence that the civil servant chose to label it Operation Vaken. Or it may have been a cry for help from somebody in Home Office doing it. This child is looking at a poster. One of these wonderful posters is now put up illegally in London. You just get some paste, put it yourself on the bus stop. A poster instructing people not to fill in the school census because there was a fear that the school census would be used to actually identify children to deport in future. If this all sounds too extreme to you, there are enough of you in the audience who can remember the 1970s in the way I can, and can remember the slogan of the National Front, which was "Go home, go back to where you come from." I never thought I would actually go up to see us actually doing this to people. And the National Front is still around. Nigel Farage claims the reason he wrote NF at school was it was his initials. There were letters about this. And it may have been just his initials. But I can remember the 1970s. And this lot are truly remarkable. These are the incoming cabinet of Theresa May, the first cabinet. Most of them are no longer there. One of the hardest things that me and Sally had to do is chart what on earth had happened to all the ministers and the new ministers and the next ministers who resigned. And in one chapter in this book, we simply list their most embarrassing public faux pas in order. There has never, ever been a British cabinet as, I don't know the right word. You have to read through it. I won't, you'll know the kind of things that they've done. You may have kind of forgotten things they asked their secretary to buy for their wife, and I won't go through the list. It's just stunning. It's the falling apart of Britain, if you like, and you can look at it purely through the behaviour of actually members of our cabinet, compared to previous cabinets, compared to the Thatcher cabinets, for instance. Who arranged vote leave? Why did they do it? What was the impetus? I'm going to go through shortly the actual geography of the vote very, very quickly. But we have to remember that this vote was arranged. There was a campaign for a long time. It didn't even start with Jimmy Goldsmith's referendum party in 1970, it was earlier than that. Matthew Elliott was the chief executive of this. The map, by the way, is Freddie Heineken's map of the splitting up of Europe. Freddie Heineken of the beer in 1992 hired two historians to predict what would happen to this continent in future. I'm not showing you Yugoslavia. They got it spot on. It's interesting to look at Britain. I think the kind of clever thing in this map is to create a region that's called Northumbria, but give its capital York. Anyway, it's really, really hard to think about how England might split. You probably can't even imagine the idea. You can certainly imagine Scotland going. I think it'd be great if Scotland went with a 66% majority. We can now understand the importance of getting a 66% majority. If you are going to try and create your own country, you really do at least want two-thirds of you to actually be in on the project. Ireland. Who knew there was no border? Who knew that we'd actually signed up that there is no border? You put a yoghurt pot on that border and you are trespassing. We've discovered this. We, of course, had agreed to it. Benedict Cumberbatch. He is no Benedict Cumberbatch. This is Dominic Cummings, as played by Benedict Cumberbatch, if you watch the documentary. The campaign director of Vote Leave. They didn't mean to win. They didn't expect to win. If they had expected to win, and Dominic is not stupid, they wouldn't have done so many things which would later would have been determined to have been illegal. They would have covered their tracks. They would have been more careful about the donations. They would have thought through what's going to happen. They, if you remember the faces of Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, wouldn't have looked so absolutely miserable the day after when they didn't get what it was they thought they were going to get. Boris thought he was going to get man of the people. He thought he was going to get the job of Prime Minister. I'm not quite sure what Gove thought he was going to get, but it wasn't this. And Dominic appears to be in hiding, as far as I can see. And I don't know where the court cases have got over the behaviour and so on. Didn't expect to win. Spread betting said they weren't going to win. The idea was a second referendum, ironically. Build up and actually have a plan. It was a little bit like going into Iraq without a plan of what you do after you've got in. There was no plan by the Brexiteers. Why was there no plan? Because they didn't expect to win the first time. Predictions of the vote. This tests people's eyesight. Front. I should tell you what's on this. This is the highest correlation of the vote. Along the y-axis, you've got percentage of Leave voters. Each dot is a local authority district. And on the x-axis, on one, you've got percent of adults with a healthy weight. And on the other, you've got percent of adults who are obese. The best predictor of how many people voted Leave in each area is the proportion of people who are fat. Just as that. I feel okay saying this because if you want to know what the difference is between overweight and obese, by the time I've had dinner tonight, I will be obese. I am currently overweight. The academic who produced this and published it 3 weeks after the result was absolutely pilloried in the Sun, Daily Express, Daily Mail. Probably rightly, because he suggested that this implied that there were people who don't plan ahead, who are they just go for something without thinking about it, and they get fat when they vote Leave. He said it was a psychology. It's nothing to do with that at all. The reasons, well, I won't go into the reasons why some people are fatter or thinner, although I'll tell you, for the fatter people in the audience, it is your genes above everything else and the environment. For the thinner people in the audience, well done, although it isn't mainly you. The thinner people, of course, I got a big health benefit, unless we have a famine, which is why we have a variation in fatness. Anyway, it is things that correlate with overweight, and above all else, what correlates with overweight, 0.79, not 0.8 here, is immigration. Because the migrants, although they didn't get a vote, on average, a healthy, young, thin and fit, and have often several university degrees. And the parts of the country to which migrants came, predominantly London, but also Oxford, but also anywhere where there's work, predominantly come, not always, but predominantly come, are the parts of the country that voted Remain. And it isn't just that the migrants tend to be fit. Migrants always tend to be healthy. It's the thing about migrants. It isn't just that they were thin. If a load of migrants turn up in your city, and unfortunately they've started turning up in very large numbers in my city, I was born in Oxford, it used to be an easier place to be fat in. Now every... Well, you can imagine how terrible it is. And what's more, we interview all these students, and as far as I can see, the main purpose of the interview is to interview three students with absolutely identical GCSEs and so on, to pick the thin one. I never see... Anyway, if you live somewhere where other people are thinner, you will get thinner yourself. If you live somewhere where other people are larger, you'll get larger. You won't notice you're getting larger because you're average. Let's go away from that. Correlation with deprivation. The correlation with deprivation is 0.03. Nothing. Nothing at all. It's not about poor people voting to leave or rich people to voting to leave. There is nothing there. Age. Age is really important. The young, far away from me, the blue is Remain. The young majority Remain, but of course the vast majority didn't get out of bed and didn't vote. If you ask them, if I ask you, 90% of people were called voting. They're not lying. We change our memories without knowing we do it. 90% of people will tell you they voted in the referendum. A high portion of the young will tell you they voted, but they didn't. 70% were in bed. They were in bed because they've been in bed since 1992, when we put them to bed. That was the first election when the young didn't vote. How do we get them into bed? We introduced the poll tax. Massive disincentive for the young to vote. Majority voting leave when you get to 45, 50, 54, 55, 64, 65 plus. And the old people vote. That's the key thing. Turnout is absolutely key. And turnout has not been understood. This little squiggly diagram is about the rise of the far right. The important thing about the rise of the far right, and by far I mean extreme right, this is BNP, UKIP, EDL, that kind of thing. It's not slow and steady. It whips up at every European election. This graph near me is the graph of support for what I call the far right. I have a very, very simple definition of far right. There is a big conservative bloc in Europe. It's called the EPP. It's the biggest set of MEPs in Europe. It's the one that Merkel's in. If you're in the EPP, you're a conservative, you're right wing. If you belong to a group to the right of the EPP, you are far right in Europe. 1979, our first election, nobody voted far right, National Front didn't stand. 1984, European election, nobody voted. 1989, should say 0.1%, NF put up some candidates. 1994, 1.1%. 1999, 7.5%, we're getting the beginning of the UKIP. 2004, UKIP get a fifth of the vote. 2009, the Tories have left the EPP. Haven't yet joined something else, they've left the EPP. 2014, the British Conservatives formed an alliance with fascist parties in the mainland, including Alternative for Deutschland, and formed a group to the right of the EPP, which I would call far right. I have another group I'd call extreme right. In the 2014 European elections, over 52% of people in Britain who voted, which was only a third, and boy is it going to be interesting to see how many vote in 2 weeks' time, 52% of people voted European far right in this country. We are it for the European far right. We send over 40 MEPs who form the bulk of the far right coalitions. The Finns have got one. Swedes have one. Alternative for Deutschland has one. We send 40. The remarkable thing, and I think it may be an empire kind of legacy, is we can't even see ourselves. What do you think they think of us on the mainland? They know. They know who in the parliament does belong to these groups, and you belong to these groups and it gets you money from Brussels. Map of European immigration, dark blue areas, over 20% of people are born abroad. The map is stretched by population, so you're not looking at Scandinavia, because although Scandinavia is wonderful, it is small. The yellow areas, less than 5% born abroad. Eastern Europe doesn't attract many migrants, less than 5%. How many people here were born outside the UK? Put your hands up. Oh, we're over average. That's about 10%. Okay, you're not representative. People who come to an evening lecture are not average of the area, but you are higher. But in general, you're living in an area where less than 1 in 20 people were born abroad. And as I said earlier, the best correlation, apart from being overweight, of course, is migrants. The fewer migrants in your area, the more likely you are to vote Leave, and the reason you're cited is the migrants. Because you've been told that the reason you can't get a house, or your children can't get a house, and you can't get a good job, and you can't get to school is the migrants. Look at Ireland. Notice how blue Ireland is? That is migration within the island. Right, that isn't large numbers of people coming from elsewhere to Ireland. That's migration within the island. That's why you don't touch that thing which is no longer a border. Look down at Spain. That's us. We're the biggest group down there. They won't all come back if we were to suddenly leave. The ones who will come back are the ones who need a hospital. Switzerland has a higher proportion. But the whole of Northwest Europe has a higher proportion apart from London. Because you've only got to grow up on the Dutch border, find a boyfriend or girlfriend just over on the German border. And if you two want to sleep in the same house, one of you has to be a migrant. There are no borders now that you could possibly impose in the majority of Europe. Dave. Let's just leave Dave for a minute. But maybe that way of behaving, that cocksuredness, where did it come from? Who taught him to believe in himself? Why did we need schools that teach you to believe in yourself so much, to just trust your judgment? Imagine that you're ruling a quarter of the population of the planet with a very small number of people. You need to educate some people to absolutely believe that they're special and to go out and run entire countries. And it's very, very useful. It's a brilliant education system if you have an empire. It's not such a great education system in this country if you don't. Here's the map of the results, just the majority minority, the yellow is Remain, the blue is Leave. This is one version of the North-South divide. It's the one, there's actually a train that used to go along it. That's one version, or you can take this one. Doesn't matter which one you do. 52% of Leave voters are below that line, which has a minority of the electorate. And I'm now going to bore you silly, but very quickly about this. By the way, 59% of Leave voters are social class ABC1, middle class, from Lord Ashcroft's exit poll. The error rate is 1%. So between 58 and 60% of Leave voters are middle class. And the majority of Leave voters live in the South. We know that to the exact voter, because we know for every place exactly how many people voted Leave, Remain, or didn't vote. I am trying to get this established as a new national walking route. Because I am determined before I die, if I do one thing as a geography professor at Oxford, it will be to explain the majority of the Leave vote came from the south of England. So this route starts off in Cornwall, 56%. 56.5% Remain, goes through Devon, 55, Dorset, 56, Hampshire, 54, Hoxley, Isle of Wight, almost 62, Sussex majority, Kent, almost 60%, Essex, 62, Suffolk majority, Norfolk majority, Cambridgeshire majority, just Hertfordshire majority, Bedfordshire, you can see how it goes round, eventually ending up in the City of London, which you may think of as the least Leave area. Only 24.7% of the entire electorate of the City of London voted Leave. But I'm going to show you for every single one of these areas, every single one of these counties, and of course I could do this because once you know it's the majority of people voted Leave down here, every single one I can find you a set of areas in the north where there were more people in electoral roll but fewer voted Leave. And God knows why this is so hard to get over to journalists. Right, Cornwall. 183,000 people vote Leave, and all that matters is the total number of Leave voters, because that is winning a national ballot. 56.5% of the electorate. I've taken the Nottinghamshire coalfield, 2,000 less Leave voters, with a good 30,000 more people who had a right to vote on the electoral roll. Actually, not, you know, real right, not people who are European citizens. The percentage might be higher in Cornwall, so of those who, sorry, in the coalfield, those who voted, 56.6% voted Leave in the Nottinghamshire coalfield. But because turnout was higher in Cornwall, Cornwall provided more Leave voters. Stoke looks like a strong Leave area because the Leavers voted. Very large numbers of people didn't vote. We always forget about them. You win this thing with a majority vote. Devon, more Leave voters. County Durham, Gateshead, Flintshire, Conway, Denbighshire. Areas that are normally seen as Leave. Devon produces more Leave voters. And who is it in Devon? It's not people in the poor parts of Devon. It's the old of Devon. How do you get into Devon if you're old? You retire into it from more affluent parts of Britain. That's why the deprivation relationship isn't there. Yes, in London, it's the poor parts of London which had some Leave voters. But in Devon, it's the affluent parts of Devon, because the old live in the affluent parts. More Leave voters in Dorset than Northumberland, North and South Tyneside. That's why there being more electors there. More Leave voters, Hampshire's my favourite. Look at this. I mean, it really was, Hampshire's enormous. Over 500,000 Leave voters, 54%. And you can add up the whole of Merthyr Tydfil, which numerous reporters went to say, how on earth could the Welsh do this? Don't they understand? The whole of Sheffield, fifth biggest city, whole of Blackpool, whole of Leeds, whole of Derby, whole of Great Yarmouth, all these areas. More Leave voters in Hampshire, despite fewer people with a right to vote. Nobody's ever gone to Hampshire and said, why did you do it? I've stuck Luton in the north for some reason. Anyway, Isle of Wight, much higher than Luton. Sussex. Okay, some Scottish areas, but beats Lincolnshire. Kent. More Leave voters in Kent than Anglesey, Stoke, Chesterfield, whole of Bradford, Preston, Salford, Sunderland, Hull and Calderdale put together. And okay, you know, Kent's pretty Leavey, but still. Essex even more. More Leave voters in Essex than in the whole of Lincoln, Rutland, Blaenau Gwent. We need another slide. And all that lot. Because in Essex they really, really did want to leave. Working class in the north. Despite the fact that the majority of Leave voters were middle class and lived in the south. I have probably bored you, but you know, if anybody wants to argue about it, we can just go round. Let's zoom. It all does the same thing. Actually, this is, it's my favourite recent photo, picture of Nigel, by the way. Finally, we're getting into areas, not yet, Somerset solidly out. More Leave voters in Somerset than Darlington, Harrogate, Stockton-on-Tees, Hartlepool, Middlesbrough, Hambleton. Lots of Guardian stories for there about why they voted Leave. None from Somerset. Let's get into the middle of London. Well, Surrey. Affluent Surrey. 47.8% Leave. More Leave voters in Surrey than Rotherham, Mansfield, Newark, Sherwood, Rushcliffe. I just think it's remarkable. We could do the same thing for London and we end up with an enormous number of areas to compare with London, and Northern Ireland has to be chucked in. And finally, anybody want to tell me which area outside of the South East had fewer Leave voters than the City of London? No, I am strange. It's Gibraltar. This pleased me. This has taken me several nights constructing the Brexit jigsaw, just to say, you can name me any part of the north and I will show you somewhere in the south where more people vote Leave. And I just think it has to be known. We're trying to make it a cycle way, by the way, because it would take far too long to walk. here's a nerdy graph. I think I've got about 10 minutes or less. And the key thing there is the white. It's showing you the difference from the average for each area, southeast, particularly high turnout, southwest high turnout, eastern region high turnout. Right. Turnout was really key. Wales, bang on the national UK average. The Welsh did nothing strange. Right. Had you taken the English out of Wales, it would be Remain. But the English who retired into Wales tipped it over. Empire, to come back to this. That's what our empire looks like in terms of population size now, of what we had. The dates are the date at which we were not invited in, and the date at which we left, almost always not of our choosing to leave. The picture there is of the last colony going, unless you think of Gibraltar as a colony, which the Spanish do. And it shows, how many of you can remember the young lady crying on the day? Yeah, you can. Yeah, they showed loads of pictures of her crying as the sun set and the Royal York Britannia went off into the distance. Prince Charles, a young Prince Charles, is just off the picture with this incredible look in his face, which is, oh my God, what do I do? It's a woman and she's crying. This is my nicest empire myth, if you like, because it's embarrassing talking about the empire. She wasn't crying because she was sad about the end of the empire. She's told us why she's crying. She was interviewed years later in a newspaper. She was crying because she couldn't understand why her mum and dad weren't letting her stay in Hong Kong so she could stay with her boyfriend. Because of course she was. She cried for 3 hours that day, and it was all filmed by the BBC, who then picked a bit to tell the story about the end of the wonderful empire. Jacob Rees-Mogg is publishing a book in a couple of weeks called Great Victorians. The greatest Victorian he starts with is Lord Palmerston. Lord Palmerston sent the gunboats in to allow free trade. Free trade of what? It's free trade of the opium we were growing in India. So we could destroy the Chinese civilization because we were the biggest drug dealer the world has ever known. Why were we growing opium in India? Because we needed the Indians to raise some money somehow to buy the textiles. Why were they buying textiles? Because we destroyed their textile industry because we had textiles to sell them that we made in Manchester. Why were we making it in Manchester? Because we shipped people from Africa because we encouraged slavery more than ever in the country over to the Americas so they could pick cotton so it could be taken back to Manchester so it could be woven and sold in India so that the drugs could then be sent to China. Nobody has a touch on us. And you know, this would be fun to learn at school. History would suddenly not be boring. No trying to remember the names of the wives that Henry VIII beheaded for some odd reason, as if it matters anymore. You know, this is exciting stuff, but we don't teach it. We're in an odd place. I gave a talk at Nuneaton a few weeks ago. This is in the back garden of the house opposite the FE College in Nuneaton. I just take pictures. We're strange. We don't protest. 1968 protests were tiny in this country compared to France. The Germans are not very good at protesting. Only 30% of them have been on a protest, but they're twice as good as we are. Now, admittedly, a few weeks ago, 1,000, almost 1,000 people did get themselves arrested. Things could be changing. I think it's the highest ever voluntary, unlike the miners' strike. Why don't we protest? We didn't have very much to protest about for 200 years. We were doing well, very, very well. When I first went to France, I was on a school trip. I was 15, and I could get 10 francs to the pound. And with 3 francs, I could buy a bottle of wine. And I had a pound. Why were we so rich? It wasn't because we invented everything. Just tell you that. If you remember having to learn about spinning jennies and Arkwright and go to the Industrial Museum in Paris. They have their own inventors. They've all got French names. It's the same inventions. This is the history of immigration to the country in one graphic, which if we were American, you'd all know by heart because they would celebrate their immigration history, but we don't. This little triangle is the recent Eastern European migration. Why did we get 1 million people? Because we went out and asked them to come. In 2003, we decided to open up the borders early, along with Sweden and somebody else everybody forgets, because we wanted people to come. It was an invitation. We've got form on this. We deliberately, unlike other countries in Europe, made ourselves available and then complained about something, which we've had again and again in our history. But you may say, oh look, there's 9 million people, Danny, you don't understand, you live in Oxford. Yeah, I live in a town that I grew up in which almost everybody is an immigrant. Almost everybody who went to school with me cannot live in my town anymore. I could get angry about it, but I don't. The immigrants, by the way, are generally English. And it's very annoying to watch where you grew up be utterly, utterly changed in the way that my hometown was. I get very annoyed when people want to complain about the Roma in Sheffield, because they've got no idea what it actually is like to watch your hometown completely altered by immigrants. And how do we vote in Oxford? We vote Remain, of course. That's what the percentage looks like if you put everybody in. And of course, as you saw the map of Europe before, you'll know that this is just common. It's what's going on all over the continent. People are moving further. They're moving out. We have our own immigrants. We call them expats. But they're somebody else's immigrant. Things are falling apart. These tents are outside the School of Geography at the University of Oxford. As far as I'm aware, there have never been people in tents in Oxford before. I was down in Folkestone, and that's literally, the pawnbroker is being kept up by iron girders. You go around, you can see why people are annoyed. Why did the negotiations go so badly? We spent a year negotiating, why did they go badly? Just before the results, Standard & Poor produced this graph. And the graph is which other countries would be most affected if Britain was to leave. And the countries were being, they got it right, Ireland, and then Malta, then Luxembourg, then Cyprus, and then Switzerland. These are all small. Switzerland doesn't get a vote because it's not in a union. Then Belgium, then the Netherlands. And finally, Spain is affected by the tourism. But to be honest, not having to look after the healthcare of our elderly is probably equals it out. It doesn't affect the big countries of Europe. We said things like, oh, but Germany sells 10% of its cars to us. Well, how many cars do you think we're going to buy from Germany now that we've closed down the plant in Swindon and we're closing down others? We're still going to buy 10%, if not 15% from Germany. It's just that we'll be buying the little ones. And we didn't realise. Why did we not realise we had no bargaining position? Because we're great. Because we're told at school that we're great. One other place has left the European community. That place is Greenland. They spent 3 years negotiating. They had 56,000 people. They came to a deal. And their deal was that we still send €500 a year for every child to Greenland because they need some help with their education. And they still have the right to come live and work in here because they can get Danish citizenship. What did the European community get in return? Got fish. Access to fishing. We don't even have fisheries that are worth bargaining over. I would not have understood or believed this until we went through a year of negotiation. Why do we have a 588-page document, which nobody seems to like, which only contains 115 words about the entire finance industry? 115 words that says we'll think about it later. It's remarkable. And it's an education. We are learning about ourselves very quickly. Trinity College, Cambridge. Tents outside the gates of Trinity College, Cambridge. Richest college in the UK. Almost at the end. What kind of things can happen? This would never have happened, I think, without Brexit. These are the increasing shares of the vote at general elections. And I talked to you earlier about what happened in 1945. This is Attlee. Attlee, bumbling old man, can't do a speech, bit posh, crap leader, manages to get a landslide in 45. But admittedly, of 10 years, there'd been a war and so on. Let's zoom forward. Here's Foot doing really, really badly. Here's Tony doing what looks like very well, but after 18 years of Conservative rule, Tony then loses votes. He then loses votes at the third general election. Gordon Brown comes in. Now, admittedly, Gordon Brown had to deal with the aftermath of the worst economic disaster, actually now worse than 1929. But he manages to lose a further 6.2% of the vote. Ed Miliband comes in, and Ed does brilliantly. 1.4% positive move to Ed is really good compared to the track record of Brown and Blair. Only you'd have to win at least 10 general elections in a row to form a government. And then this man, who can't do a talk, who doesn't believe in nuclear Armageddon, gets 9.6%. That was out of the range of possibilities of everything that's ever happened. This is, again, looking at swing. This is the swing of April, May, June, July 2017. I've drawn 2,000 graphs of that kind. Every political party, every poll we've ever had, nothing has ever happened like that before, that fast, until the Brexit Party, who've just beaten Corbyn, at least in the polls, in the last couple of weeks. We are in completely uncharted territories. Anything can happen. The one fascinating thing for Labour is, when you win, you disappoint. So Labour lost in the early 50s. Okay, they held on here, but they lost votes, disappointed. Because you can never actually give people what you promise in your manifesto. But you get this shift, and then you don't win. You may well be disappointed in him, but you're not disappointed in a Labour government that isn't delivering what it promised to deliver, because there is no Labour government there not to deliver. You don't notice when things change, because they change all around you. We think now is normal. We don't think of ourselves as the most far-right country of Europe, but you've forgotten that only 10 years ago we were celebrating bankers partying in the City of London, spending £30,000 on a bottle of champagne. All that's gone. Now we worry about a fire in a block of flats in West London in a way we wouldn't have worried about a fire. And we worry particularly about a fire in that block of flats because of where it was near to. Because you can actually stick a camera and get the frontage of £1 million properties with the flats in the background. Last graph, I think. If you don't believe we're odd, we are currently spending around about 36% of our GDP on public services. A few other countries outside of Europe do the same. The Labour manifesto is to take that up to 38, just below Spain. Finland, France, Denmark, Belgium, Austria, Sweden, Italy, Portugal, Norway, Germany, Netherlands. If you want a health service that works, if you want schools that work, if you want public housing that works, if you want a decent society, you pay for it. If you don't pay for it, you get crap. It isn't due to the immigrants. It's really that simple. Geographical comparisons. I've got no time for that, and I promise you no more graphs. I will tell you this one. Inequality here, international test of ability in maths. Not done at age 16, done later. 16 to 24. And the two countries where people can't do maths the most are the UK and USA. Why? Because examinations are really, really important here and in the USA, because USA and UK are really divided countries, if you're listening to Angus Deaton and his colleagues the last few days. So it really, really matters what grade you get, because it's a difference between having to work cleaning all your life or being paid to sit in an office and complain how terrible it is to get £25,000 or £40,000 a year because of the emails you get. And it all depends on whether you get a C at GCSE maths or an A star. Same in America. So we teach people to get C's and A's and A stars. What we don't teach people is how to do maths. And we don't even understand that. We teach people to maximise their mark on a particular day. I could give you some GCSE maths questions now, but I'm out of time. And you, almost all of you, would not do very well. It's not your fault. It's the British education system, because we're such an unequal country. Europe at night. The lights are not going out all over Europe. The far right is falling in popularity more than it is rising in most European countries. It is just never reported. When Golden Dawn go down in Greece, we don't report it. When they come up, we report it. When it looks like a far-right person will become president of Austria, we report it. When it goes down, we don't report it. The mainland is doing fine. The mainland has discovered that its borders are no more because we've done a wonderful service. We have demonstrated that you cannot easily just leave. It didn't necessarily have to be us. It was probably going to be somebody. But in a way, we have done a favour. That. We've done another favour. We're about to begin to spread out the banking industry of Europe across the continent. It didn't need to be so concentrated in London. We have over 3,000 bankers now paid over €1 million still a year. Paid over €1 million each year because they said if they weren't paid that much, they'd move somewhere else to work. The next highest number was 197 in Germany. There are no banking jobs for them to go to. The Swiss bankers are paid half as much. But the great news now is that their bluff's been called. The jobs are moving. The banks are moving. The Japanese banks have already moved the CEOs and the COOs and the capital. They just left the back office in London. And it doesn't matter what we do now, they're going because they've lost the trust in Britain. And that isn't necessarily a bad thing. Our only problem is that between now and when we sort ourselves out, we're going to need some money. And as banking drops, the pound drops and we get more tourists, universities are the second best thing to the banks that we actually have for export earning. We call it overseas students. We thought we were the second biggest arms trader in the world. It turns out we're the sixth and dropping rapidly. Not that you necessarily want to be an arms trader, but hey, things are getting a bit desperate. It's going to be very tough for the next 5, 10, 15 years. The question is whether you can make that 5 years tough rather than 15 years tough, and whether out of this, if the young vote, and we will find out again in 2 weeks' time, will they actually vote for something radically different and tell people of my age and older, sorry, I know you had our interests at heart, but you didn't understand. It's not your fault you didn't understand. It was in your textbooks at school, and your textbooks lied to you. Thank you very much.
To take some questions. We have some roving mics. So can I invite some questions, please, for Danny?
As you probably guessed, my hair color, I probably remember the 70s even more vividly than you do, came through that period. But I came tonight not exactly knowing what a geographer was. You're going to tell us how off my legs are falling, perhaps. You told me a lot of things that I was not aware of, and that have revised many of the opinions that I had. I spent some time last night reading some of the extracts from that book and from your previous one. And one of the comments that I think was put online after was that you were advocating a radical socialist government. And I thought, oh my God, this is awful, I'm going to go along and see this guy put in right. You put me right, thank you.
I should explain your fair legs. The reason we taught Oxford Lakes and those other things, Jardines and Soylent and so on, is that we couldn't teach what we had been teaching a decade and 2 decades before. My department thought it was started through an advertisement in the Times newspaper, asking for funds to begin to start the department because we needed to train young men to run the colonies. So my department set up to train colonies, that's why Geoffrey O'Neill came in. You need to know about floods because you might be charged for a large one. Could these mountains, volcanoes? Why do you think we're talking about volcanoes? Because you might be the officer in charge. And geography did very well until the 60s and 70s, when the demand for colonial officers dropped. And we couldn't, we still taught the source geography. We told people where to go for tin and rubber and so on. And that's why we taught you where to go, but that wasn't so useful anymore. And so we sort of scraped the bottom of the barrel when we came out and we got Stone Age for a bit. But the wonderful thing for geography, not for the planet, we got to such a low point in the late 70s, early 80s, that my colleagues who are called physical geographers, we fall into two kinds of rocks that you can tell very physical. My colleagues who are physical geographers used to go to the Alps every summer, and as an excuse for Felix's work, they used to climb up mountains to measure the glaciers to find out how quickly the ice age was coming. I was taught to score, I thought it was coming. Most of you my age told me thought it was coming. And they kept on measuring the glaciers, and they thought they were getting it wrong, so they had to go back next summer to the Alps. And eventually they worked out that the thing was actually retreating. So now geography is at the heart of climate change science, is a sexy subject. The only bad news is the planet's in trouble. It changes, but we have this history we don't like to talk about because of what we were created to do.
Mark. As ever, Danny, thank you for highly stimulating talk and a kind of challenging data analysis. Got a question about the construction of the narrative of Left Behind Places. So the Guardian narrative by John Harris, who of course lives on Hay on Wye, of course, on that construction of the narrative. What's striking about your talk is the Southeast did it, the middle class folks did it. If you read the popular press, the narrative is Left Behind Places, like Stoke-on-Trent, 69.4% of the vote did it. Why did that Southeast middle class analysis not feed itself into the popular press? Is it about the particular position of the media and the Guardian? Your data is striking on that. You're probably the first to look at that kind of data at a particular scale. If you look at all the John Darmacos and John Harris analysis that ran through that, about post-industrial northern towns, Wales, etc. It was always about kind of an absolute vote, not the proportion that turned out. Is it about the left and the media in that analysis that's driving that? That's a striking thing about
it. I mean, part of it was, there was a narrative before about how Labour were going to lose votes to UKIP in the north. So there's a kind of building up story before on the left that this was a big issue for Labour. In the end, actually, the party who lost votes to UKIP were the Conservatives, now the Brexit Party. The main reason was that by the day before the referendum, we were almost certain what was going to happen. The spread betting that got every general election right recently, every American election right, and the spread betting was saying there was no chance of Remain losing. The win was not much, but they would win. And then Joe Cox was murdered. And for people like me, that's just it. Very rarely is an MP killed, let alone stabbed to death with somebody shouting out what he shouted. And the script for W1A, the BBC, was they were already for their 10-hour marathon, and they sit there desperately trying to talk about something with very little information. And then Sunderland came in, because it always comes in first, because they were. And it didn't go to script. And they were shocked on the night, and the camera zoomed into a blonde woman with them next to two tall men. And that set the story, and then they winged it. And the BBC studio, they winged it through. I'm almost exactly the same age as John. I like John. The difference is I grew up in Oxford, he grew up somewhere near Manchester, not that poor, but okay, and he's got much better knowledge of music than me, particularly Northern music. And then John had to go down to London to work, because that's what he has to do as a journalist. So, if you have to go away from nice people and nice hills to somewhere pretty horrible for a job, you can, I think, get a... And it is left behind. The whole country's been left behind by London. The best predictor of how you do economically is how long does it take a train to get to London. That tells you how. So Wellington as well. That's great. I think John had that. I'm very nerdy. That's what I was looking. That's what. looking at the numbers, and I just came across this by chance. I wrote it up in the British Medical Journal 3 weeks after the vote, which may sound very odd. The great thing about the British Medical Journal is they really, really, really check the statistics, because they're publishing things that actually matter about people dying. People just assume I must have made a mistake. But then I did a really bad job of explaining it, which is why I'm still going around saying, this is a majority, and of course it was. Most people who voted to leave normally voted Tory or UKIP, where the most Tory and UKIP voters live, they live in the south. Most people who voted to leave are old, where the most old people in Britain live in the south. People die earlier in the north. Sometimes higher, I mean, they do, it's tragic, but it fitted a particular story. I do love that. The other thing I think that went on was that, of course, the people in the studio at W1A on that night at the BBC, they knew who voted to leave, personally. Their parents had voted to leave, who lived in Hampshire, or Surrey, or Wiltshire. But it was so much easier to blame this thing that they hated, because, of course, the entire BBC voted for Maine, on those other people who were not clever enough to be like them, even though their own parents, odds on, wealthy, middle class suburbs, weren't voted leave. The reason I should say is sincerity. The old voted leave for the good of the young and their grandchildren. Yeah, they knew that it wasn't, oh, my future will be wonderful. It was a very sincere leave vote. It was, I could start a family in the early 20s. I would get a mortgage when I was 24. I'd have full employment. Had a holiday. Half of all children, now almost half, no longer have a summer holiday in this country. And of course, sovereignty as well for some people, and absolute racism for some others. But the bulk of it was, I want my grandchildren to have a life at least as good as the one I have. So I think it's a very sincere vote.
There's a question from Joe Morley, who is sitting just in the middle of the auditorium.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Danny, for that contribution tonight. I've just got kind of three things that have gone through my mind. And you started off by saying about the importance of optimism. I just wonder how much we can take optimism away from the evening tonight when we actually leave. But I want to try and link that to what I think is really important about everything being connected, and the way in which the inequalities is all part and parcel and sort of long-term about the whole sustainability agenda. And what you were saying about young people and about whether or not what we've seen over the last few months or so in respect of young people and climate change and everything else, how that could maybe link in much more to this agenda. Which then brings me on to just what do we do about our democratic institutions in this country. And the key thing that you were talking about was possibly turnout. And how do we actually relate this whole interconnected debate which needs to take place and link it to our democratic institutions where we see, you know, trade unions no longer as influential as they once were. We haven't got that kind of institutional base back into our democracy anymore. Yeah, I'm just interested.
Okay.
How optimistic can we be?
I think you can, I am actually, but still counterfactual. Imagine that Remain had won by 52%. Which is what the Leave organisers were expecting. Remain 52, Leave 48. The immigrants would have carried on being blamed for everything. The environment would have become even more hostile. We would be heading for another referendum. It would take a 66% vote not. The Leavers were determined, the men with the money, the millions, this mattered a lot. And we go through their life histories about who their servants were with their children. When they were living in the colonies, the nanny was meant to be black. It's fascinating to learn the history of the men. I won't mention them, but the book was meant for libel. And the only thing we had to take out was suggestions that Eton College might have cheated in exams, because it hasn't been completely proved.
Let's
So I think if you can do that in your head, and there'll be people who want to recommend, there'll be people who have never heard this argument before. I'm not campaigning for Remain, but in hindsight, a 52% Remain win wouldn't have settled this. So I think what turnout was high overall, because for the first time in many, not most people's lives in Britain, they're actually not a vote that matters. In the majority of constituencies, your vote really doesn't matter. We've also now demonstrated that the Westminster Parliament doesn't work. You could argue theoretically your whole life that we should have a voting system like they have in Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, the rest of the mainland of Europe, everywhere, you know, a voting system where your vote actually counts. But actually, until Westminster fell apart, it'll be harder to think how are we going to end up in the situation in which that will come in. And it has emboldened the young in a very different way. It has shown that it matters if you do something. I have had to tell students of mine not to get arrested because they don't all hold British passports. And it doesn't matter who you are. If you're arrested in London because you're worried about the climate, if you don't hold a British passport, you can be deported. Now, never in my life as a university lecturer have I actually been in a situation where very young students are actually talking about their demonstrations and the rest. And so now I've been involved in 13 and 14 year olds who've been locked up for taking action on the coal trains to tracks and so on. I'm still in court and given the longest witness statements ever about the one from academic Dr. X's, who's just been arrested for doing something of dubious legality to stop playing taking off from the airport. But I've never had the thought to try to calm 18, 19, 20, 21 year olds down and to think carefully, don't get arrested unless you've got a British passport, because if you've got a British passport, that's your only passport, they can't deport you. The thousands of arrests were much bigger in 1968 than the LC. So what's just happened, very well organised, quite posh, incredible lawyers behind it, and support teams, big people up, and then love letters anonymously get sent out to the universities, say well done. There's currently a plan to build a motorway to Oxford Cambridge government plan. Because when Empire 2.0 works, when we leave, it's going to be so successful, London's going to become enormous, and we need to build 300,000 houses in Oxfordshire, we need a motorway. Now you think about trying to build a motorway to Oxford Cambridge if you know there's 1,000 people that are willing to get arrested on the bridge in the middle of London. It's not going to happen. I am optimistic. I wouldn't worry. The other reason for optimism is you may be really annoyed right now with what's happening with this or that political party. Try to remember what it was that really annoyed you 2 months ago, 3 months, four, five. There would have been something. You've almost certainly forgotten it. It would be, why couldn't they have done this? Why don't they do that? It's normally, why can't Jeremy lead? He can't. He said. But trying to think of the thing that really annoys you each month for the last few months, you'll find you've forgotten most of it. And the thing that really annoys you right now, which is going on, whatever it will be, you will have forgotten about it in 4 months right now because things are moving so fast. We're heading up to the 31st of October, yet another deadline. And by then, we'll have forgotten everything so far.
I'm going to take two more questions. I'm going to take a question here first, and then a question over in the background, and then we will have to bring to a conclusion. Gavin there, please.
This week is Mental Health Awareness Week, and there's a lot of work that seems to be suggesting that Brexit anxiety is creating mental health problems left, right, and centre. But I suppose the question I have is, to what degree is there some kind of relationship between mental health issues, very low-level mental health issues, in the run-up to the referendum and voting leave that might come from some kind of generalised pissed-offness that just comes from basically people being sold a book where they basically said everybody's life's going to be great, and then everybody's feeling possibly via the internet, but somewhere, someone somewhere is having more fun mm-hmm. and has got more money than they have.
Mm-hmm. We haven't got good data on it yet. I mean, the mental health data we do have over a long period suggests that mental health is worse in the UK than other European countries. It's worse than the USA. It's pretty well directly related to inequality. Self-harming amongst 15-year-old girls in particular correlates internationally. So if you're worried about your 15-year-old girls self-harming or not eating, you should emigrate to a more equal country. The interesting question is why do people like me not learn Finnish? Do that. We don't know. I mean, the only thing I know, ironically, because I have been talking to the boss of a pharmaceutical company recently, the planning for Brexit has been absolutely incredible. We have spent millions and millions, and she was involved in the planning because, whatever they call selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, her boyfriend was Prozac, don't have a very long shelf life. But at least one in 10 people. Probably the selection that are on an equivalent of one of these. And they make it easy to get to the day. They couldn't warehouse enough for more than two or three work weeks' worth for Britain. And this was actually seen as. So, of course, the epilepsy drugs and the other ones, the insulin, are the most important. And hence, we buy more fridges than anybody else that bought on the planet. Actually, the antidepressants was looking very tricky. Because the drug companies can't suddenly make lots more of these things, suddenly. And if they were to give us a stockpile, which of course would run out because it's got a sell-by date, we'd have to take it away from some other place that's actually using them. And it's realizations of things like that. Realizations about what you do is only wanting sheep carcasses. Gold Command actually hired 3,000 to 5,000 people shortly before the 29th of March. And it was a giant call centre in London, paid twice the normal hourly rate to the civil servants, where you'd at least be able to get through to somebody on the phone. They just got the phone. They wouldn't be me on Long Ear, Kent, or whatever else and work. But we tried our hardest. You know, we really have this really interesting demonstration. We have tried to work out how you could do this that quickly. Of course it's possible. And also an empire mentality does give you stiff upper lip. I mean, our friends who are working on apartments at the leavers, and one of these ex-RE is brilliant to leave, just says, we'll just get through it. And of course that's what helps you win and run an empire. And we could. It's just what would we have left at the end of it.
Speaking of the end, I'm going to make this sort of the final question.
Thank you, Professor Dorling. I was very interested in your remarks about the W1A situation and their parents, almost certainly in Wiltshire, Hampshire, etc., voting Leave for the sake of their children and grandchildren. I am old, most of my friends are old. I and all the people I know well voted Remain for the sake of our children and our grandchildren. I want my son, who travels internationally for work, to be able to travel freely throughout Europe without any visa or passport hindrances. I want my grandchildren to be able to work in Europe, and I want them to feel part of an open, free Europe where they are welcome, where they feel part of an important community of people. And you said, what were we angry about today? What were we angry about 2 months ago? I have been angry for a long, long time, long before the vote, because of people like Nigel Farage and his attitudes. I've been angry and upset since the referendum and the declaration that we were going to leave, and it continues to upset me that we live and our children and grandchildren will live in a country of such attitudes. I wish we had never been involved in this situation at all.
I have to agree with you, although I say this has brought things to a head and out of this we may get something better. One of the saddest things about this, because it can't be the fault of people like me, you know, we were sitting at high tables in a posh university in a town, we've got a single shop closed down in Oxford, and like Sheffield, their third closed down. Just not worrying about the mess of what was going on. I partly agree because when you do international comparisons of countries, which I do, you find that Finland scores 1, 2, or 3 out of 105 different social indicators, which I think top happiest country in the world, best education. And actually, in 105 different measures, it's first, second, or third. Now, we used to be second for arms dealers, but now we're six. We're second for Olympic medals. US is first, but US is also the fattest and the second fattest. And we're going to introduce the sitting down sports into it. The one thing we were really exceptionally good at in some of these things was multiculturalism and tolerance. We ranked higher than the rest of Europe, acceptance of mixed marriages and so on. Partly because we've had an empire longer, we've had more immigration. You know, practically every family in Britain has a second cousin or somebody who's not white. But we were pretty good on the figures on racism. And one of the saddest things of this is that one thing that you could say about Britain, that you wouldn't be treated the same way here as say in rural Netherlands, where you'll still be often served last if you're not white. We've managed to harm, and the number of attacks has increased since about. And people feel they can say things that they didn't feel that they could say before. But it was in their head. So whenever you look at surveys of who gets off the job and who doesn't, whose job application is pushing it in because their name looks funny and isn't, that's all in our heads. So just to end on optimism, I would have preferred if we hadn't gotten here. David Cameron only offered this in the manifesto because he was sure he wasn't going to get the majority government in 2015. The plan was never to get to here. But having got to here, we're now obliged to actually deal with things like racism in a way that we rather comfortably weren't, as we kind of gradually said, "Are we wonderful and mixed?" But actually, in the heads of many of us, there was this. So I think we have to blatantly call it out now and create something which really is post-empire. And you can go back, and I won't do it because I have time. It's a very unique situation in the world to have been the richest place in the world, ranked number one, and come down. It took the moments, a hell of a long time. I won't get through the list. Russia, so did the USSR, Istanbul, so did the Ottoman Empire. Right. Going down the ranks is actually really difficult. It takes 3 or 4 generations to become normal. And that is the process I think we're in. We can use this as a reason to actually confront certain kinds of behaviours and say, you absolutely can't do this. We of all nations have no right to behave in a way that is racist, given what we inflicted on the rest of the world. Gordon Brown said in his book, we invaded over 170 of the current 193 members of the United Nations. Nobody else will ever get that record again. But it's time we actually sort of face up to it. What our past actually was, and then try to work out, with all the advantages of the English language, with all the advantages of being in this particular point, this place in the world, which is an intersection, what can we actually do that's just helpful to the rest of the planet and people, rather than still trying to work out what can we do that's going to really benefit us because we've got so used to getting stuff from everywhere else. And it's trying to learn how to do that is going to be difficult. Thank you very much.
wanted to thank Dan Dorling for finishing on that qualifying note of optimism, certainly an important point about the need to call out, which is a quite brilliant answer to a challenging and urgent question. I also want to thank Danny for a superb lecture, which took us from geography as a discipline that trained its disciples for the management of empire to become, as it best demonstrated this evening, a discipline that asks complex questions about demography, which overturn assumptions that run rife in media narratives. And leads to the asking of critical questions. So I'd just invite you to thank again Danny for a superb question, for a superb lecture and superb responses to the questions.